Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, you had a bit of a scoop the other night that has to do with President Joe Biden's upcoming reported trip to Israel that we're expecting sometime in the end of June.
Yeah, so in the discussions between the White House and the Prime Minister's office about Biden's visit, which is not final, but the White House brought up that they want to visit Al-Makassed Hospital, which is in East Jerusalem. There are several Palestinian hospitals in the eastern end of Jerusalem, and that's the biggest one. And just the Trump administration had revoked $25 million from, I believe it's called the East Jerusalem Palestinian Hospitals Network, something like that, of which the hospital is a member. And Biden wants to reinstate, I'm not sure how much of the funds, but they're going to reinstate some of the funds, and they want to sort of visit the hospital as some sort of big rollout. But politically and diplomatically, this is significant beyond the restoration of funds to the Palestinians, post-Trump, which is a whole other area that we could discuss. But Biden would be visiting the hospital, if he visits, without any Israelis. It would be like a visit to quote-unquote Palestine, or just to a Palestinian site, and they don't want Israelis involved in the visit. And it's sort of making a statement that this part of Jerusalem is not Israeli. And that's going farther than really any previous U.S. president has gone. Like, U.S. presidents have, up until Trump, did not officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, but they didn't get into it sort of at that level. And I have to give credit because Biden wanting to visit East Jerusalem without Israelis was first reported on Kan, Israel's public broadcaster. And I brought in the scoop of what exactly, where exactly he wants to go, which is this hospital, to reinstate the funding.
So after we've given credit, and credit is, credit is due where it's deserved. So yes to Kan. But here's what I don't get about this whole story. Al-Makassed Hospital, I've seen it before. I was there. It's on the Mount of Olives. It's a part of Jerusalem, right? If the president wants to give some sort of recognition to the Palestinians, why doesn't he go to Bethlehem? Why doesn't he go to Ramallah? Why East Jerusalem? So, to me, it seems like there's a bigger message, kind of what you're talking to, of the significance of East Jerusalem as part of a future Palestinian state, maybe. Like, is that where he wants to? Because the Biden administration had spoken about reopening a consulate for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. They haven't done that yet because of Israeli opposition. So maybe that's what this is about.
Well, there's a little bit of a misconception, because the consulate is actually in West Jerusalem, not East Jerusalem. I mean, for those who like to make that division, but it's near like the Waldorf Astoria mm-hmm. Hotel and Park Atzmaut and all that. It's very much like or hardly anyone would envision that as not being part of Israel. However, I guess the Americans feel like if there still is no consulate and they're not able to keep that promise to reopen a consulate there because Israel is blocking it, Israel opposes that, then they need to do something, to show the Palestinians that they also recognize a Palestinian foothold in Jerusalem. That would be my guess. It's interesting. You mentioned that the hospital is on the Mount of Olives. And I mean, while internationally there's little to no recognition of it being part of Israel, I mean, I don't think that that's something that Israelis would ever want to give up, as part of a Palestinian state. It's outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem for sure. But, thousands of years of important Jewish figures and just family members of Jews are buried there.
No, you know what we'll do? We'll take Menachem Begin, the Israeli prime minister, who's buried on the Mount of Olives, and we'll hand over his grave to the Palestinian Authority, right? I mean, come on.
I'm sure they'll treat him really
well. I'm sure they will,
because they'll take great
care
of it.
Yeah, they always do. But that's why I look at this and I say that the visit to East Jerusalem carries with it greater significance to some extent than just a random visit to Ramallah or Bethlehem. Trump, when he came here, met with Abu Mazen, the Palestinian Authority president in Bethlehem. We've seen other world leaders who have come to Israel before and also gone to Ramallah to meet with the Palestinian leadership. This is something else. And if it stands on its own and it doesn't include a visit to the West Bank, is in itself very interesting.
Yeah.
And carries a message with it.
I see it as like a rolling back of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem, maybe not in the letter, but definitely in spirit. You know, when Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, they didn't name specific borders or boundaries within Jerusalem, sort of leaving the options open for negotiations. And this is the Biden administration saying, like, no, we're drawing a line for you here.
Well, Israel will have to figure out a way to deal with that.
But I think that one of the ways Israel's dealing with it, by the way, because as I wrote in the story, I got this information from an Israeli official. I mean, I think they're leaking the story in order to kill it. Like, I think that's why it's out, because the Bennett wants to stop the visit. We'll see if it works.
Could be. And Israel does feel that by floating the, for example, if I compare it to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps delisting, the IRGC being taken off the State Department's foreign terrorist organization list, that also helped kind of stick a stick in the wheels that were moving towards a renewal of the JCPOA. Maybe they feel that they can do the same here too. Maybe that successful torpedoing diplomacy is something they feel they can reenact. But what I wonder, Lahav, is if the trip will even happen. Because if it's scheduled for the end of June, and you had told me that the reason they want to do it then is because the president is going to be traveling to attend a meeting of the G7, so it's a good time to just jump over to the Middle East, it will also depend if there's a government, right? Because if the Israeli government falls apart by then and implodes, highly doubtful that the U.S. president would come here when we don't have a functioning government.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's all, and I think that's part of the reason why everyone I talk to about this trip says it's not final.
So that leads me to my question, Lahav. Is the government going to survive until the end of June?
I'm pessimistic. I think I said this in an earlier episode that, like, my prediction is an election in the last quarter of this year. I just don't see how this government will survive unless something very surprising happens. You know, they don't have a majority of the Knesset. They, even within the coalition, like, Ra'am right now is very unhappy about things going on in Jerusalem in terms of the Temple Mount and Jordan's role on the Temple Mount. They want Jordan to have even greater of a role. And they're, you know, there have been minority governments, like governments with less than 161 seats in the Knesset that have lasted for quite some time. But a coalition that's going to have, without Ram, they're going to have, I think, 54 seats. Like, that doesn't seem like that's going to last very long. So I'm very skeptical.
Honestly, I'm skeptical too. And what I hear from politicians as well as people within the prime minister's circle is that they predict that this will not last longer than maybe a month or two, that sometime in June things will kind of come to an end, which leads a lot of open questions, right? How does it end? What happens? Is it a bill that disperses the Knesset that brings it down? Is it that someone pulls out in addition to Idit Silman, the coalition whip who moved from the Amina party of Prime Minister Bennett to the opposition? Or is it that Ram, Mansour Abbas's party, the Arab Islamic party, is upset because of more action either on the Temple Mount, or let's even say there's an operation in Gaza? Let's say that, you know, Israel feels this need, and we saw just over the weekend how a lot of Israelis were starting to talk about how Israel needs to target and kill Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, because he was the one who called on Palestinians in the West Bank to take axes and to go kill Israelis. And then two guys went and listened to that and killed three people last Thursday night with axes. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. They followed it to the literally to the dot. And they took axes and killed three fathers in Elad, leaving 16 orphans, right? I mean, that's astounding. Two fathers with five kids, one father with six kids.
Just like a sidebar, one of those children, a six-year-old boy, watched his father be killed. I mean, after his father was struck with the axe as he was dying, he said to the boy to go call police. And that's what, I mean, he saw his father die and he ran to call police. And it's just like such a heartbreaking, insane story.
It's crazy. Those guys have thankfully been caught, and they'll probably spend the rest of their lives in jail or until we do another prisoner swap.
Yeah.
But would Mansour Abbas be able to stay in a government that goes to a war in Gaza? That's kind of what's been on my mind. And I wonder if the government's not considering that as it considers what to do against this wave of Palestinian terror.
I mean, I think that this was the question about this government from the start, right? Sure, there are all kinds of domestic policy issues that, you know, Rahm and like Meretz might disagree on because Rahm is socially conservative and Meretz is progressive. But I think the real issue about this coalition's survival that people always ask about is what if there's a war? And now we haven't even had a war, right? I mean, there's a wave of terrorism, and I don't think the wave of terrorism is the issue for Rahm. I think it's all about the Temple Mount, right? And we had this rioting on the Temple Mount. And then, of course, Israeli police responded to quell the rioting. And now Jordan is mad at Israel because they think Israel is, you know, overdoing it, I guess. And Rahm is sort of taking the side of Jordan. So it's like not even a war. But for Israelis to give up more sort of the sovereignty on the Temple Mount to Jordan, I mean, that's certainly how Prime Minister Bennett is framing it, is a non-starter, right? And there was a report on the day that we're recording this that Israel had approved 50 more workers for the Waqf. The Waqf is the Islamic Trust run by Jordan as part of their custodianship of Muslim and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem. And Bennett immediately denied it, and he said, no, I'm not giving in to Jordanian pressure. We're not letting them bring in more workers. And not only that, but last month we kicked out 6 Waqf workers because they were Hamas sympathizers. So, you know, this tension with Rahm and within the coalition, on the one hand, it doesn't look like it's changing Bennett's policies on this front, although, you know, there's a couple days between when we record and the podcast comes out, so I can't say for sure. But that's what it looks like so far. But on the other hand, you know, that his coalition might collapse.
You know, you and I have spoken about this in the past, and I think this is something that we both agreed upon, of just the Israeli failure to really apply sovereignty to the Temple Mount is a stain on Israel over the years. You know, the fact is, yes, there's a reality, and we have to recognize reality to an extent, and the geopolitical complexity of what happens there. But, you know, what people fail to remember, the one place where there's no religious freedom in Israel is on the Temple Mount. And it's not because the Muslims can't pray there. It's because Jews aren't allowed to pray there, right? It's an insane reality. And Israel gives hand to it because it feels like it's stuck and it doesn't want to be the one seen as instigating a larger conflict, so-called religious war with the Muslim world. But this is not, I mean, you don't see this in other countries, right? That the Jewish state, its most holiest place, the Temple Mount, is a place where we say to Jews, no, you can only go up certain days, you can only go up certain numbers, there's a quota on how many can go up, only certain times, and when you're up there, there's only certain things you can do. I mean, that doesn't exist anywhere else.
No, and it's a very, let's say, disheartening. I mean, frankly, some of the rumors that incited Palestinians into violence was that the Temple Mount was going to be set up similarly to the way the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron is set up, which means there are, you know, it's sort of split in half and there's different hours and different zones for Jews and Muslims. In my opinion, that would be actually a really good solution for the Temple Mount. But apparently to Muslim extremists, it's bad enough to murder people over.
And sadly, they've murdered people even on the Temple Mount. I mean, we don't have to go back that far in time when they went and killed two Druze Arab policemen on the Temple Mount, right? And Israel wanted to go ahead and erect metal detectors outside the Temple Mount. You know, I mean, this is another thing that the world fails to remember. When you want to go visit the Western Wall, you have to go through a metal detector. I go through a metal detector. You go through a metal detector. An American tourist, a European tourist, an Asian tourist. Everybody goes through metal detectors to go to the Western Wall. To go up to the Temple Mount, right? So Jews who want to pray at the Western Wall go through a metal detector. If you are an Arab who wants to go pray at the Temple Mount, you do not go through a metal detector. That's crazy, right? So they're able to go in, bring weapons, right? Kill people on the Temple Mount. And then when we said, okay, now we want to try to create a normal reality where everybody goes through metal detectors, also people go to the Temple Mount, they pressured and they boycotted and prayed outside the temple.
By the way, Jews who go to the Temple Mount have to go through metal detectors, but Muslims don't.
Of course, yeah. Of course, but Arabs don't. But Muslims don't. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with this situation.
And you know, in the end of the day, I think that a lot of the Muslims suffer from this. And it sort of says, like, Israel cares about the security of its citizens and wants to make sure that the Western Wall is secure. And therefore, we have metal detectors. When Israel tried to put up those metal detectors after the two Druze policemen were killed, Jordan complained, and then Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to cancel the metal detectors and take them off. And to me, that says that Jordan doesn't care about the lives of Muslims who are praying on the Temple Mount. Wouldn't they want security? But no, they don't want security because they would rather make a point about Israeli sovereignty.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's more to undermine Israeli sovereignty and to get us to fold and to show the Muslim world and themselves that they are the ones who hold the keys, the metaphorical keys to the Temple Mount. On this week's podcast, we actually have a really interesting conversation with Yair Golan. And Yair Golan, just to our listeners, he's the former deputy chief of staff, spent about 38, 39 years in the IDF, climbing from the bottom all the way almost to the top. He was one of the final candidates to become the chief of staff, but he lost out to the current chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi. And then he joined politics, but unlike what we've seen in the past, I think he might be the first general to go to the Meretz party, which is really the far left of the Israeli political spectrum. And he's been very vocal as a left-wing ideologue in this government especially, but even before joining this government, a big critic of Netanyahu. But we spoke to him because the Knesset resumed its summer session this week. And this is supposed to be a real tough session for the government and the coalition, which Meretz is a part of, to survive and to see if this coalition will last. But one thing that struck me and I wanted to talk about with you was the fact that here you have a guy who's been 38 years in the army, has really seen it all, has fought against Arab terrorism, whether it's in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank, whether it's along the border with Lebanon and inside Lebanon during the Second Lebanon War, all over the place. And he is of the opinion we need to disengage. And he talks about that in the podcast. We need to disengage from the Palestinians. We need to disengage from the Palestinians. And then I thought of the movie Gatekeepers. Remember that movie with the heads of Shabak?
Yeah.
And they too were all, we have to disengage. We have to make peace. We have to pull out, two-state solution. What do they know that the Israeli public don't know? And what is it how is it that they don't succeed in convincing the Israeli public? Because most Israelis, as we know, don't agree with them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the way most Israelis look at it, right, as far as I can tell, is that we tried Oslo and we ended up with, you know, bus bombings all over Israel. Barak tried to give up 97% of the disputed territory, and we ended up with the Second Intifada. Ariel Sharon disengaged from Gaza, and we're still dealing with rockets constantly from Gaza. And so Israelis just don't think trying more of the same concessions will do anything, but I don't know why they don't see it that way. I mean, is it that they engage somewhat with Palestinians and Palestinians tell them these things? I don't know.
It's interesting. And Golan goes ahead and articulates it, I think, quite well of the way he sees the situation. But it still lends some wonder, I guess, of what is it that he's seeing that and they can't succeed, right? You would think that all these heads of Shabak, all these generals who kind of leave, and by the way, chiefs of staff, I think ultimately would agree with his analysis, although they might not go as far as he is to the left extreme in a party like Meretz, but they would agree that we have to find a way to disengage. But they also can't convince the Israeli public, right? There's some failure, and I think you're probably right. It does have to do to an extent with the fact that most Israelis feel like we've tried over and over again, and we keep on getting met with terrorism as opposed to a real hand outreach for peace.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that people should listen to the interview. He's interesting. He's definitely not subtle. You know, he puts it all right out there.
So here we go. Yair Golan, Merit MK, former IDF Deputy Chief of Staff. We're joined by retired Major General Yair Golan, who's the current Deputy Minister of Economy, a member of Knesset with merits. Yair Golan has about 38 or 39 years behind him in the IDF and all of the different roles that one could possibly imagine. So also a very good person to talk about with the recent and the ongoing wave of terror. And also recently wrote an op-ed in the Jerusalem Post, or co-authored an op-ed in the Jerusalem Post that spoke about the Iran deal. So we're also going to get to that at the end. But first, Yair, we thank you for joining us. And we're talking to you as the Knesset summer session is just getting going. The coalition that you are a member of seems to be a bit shaky these days. Is it going to last?
Well, I have to admit that it's a matter of responsibility. It's a matter of whether all members of the coalition manage to handle themselves in the most restrained and passionate way in order to let this good government, this crucial government for the destiny of Israel, to continue with its deeds. I think this is the issue. And I think this is what is truly needed after so many years of poison that was injected into the political system. So I call this government a cure government for the Israeli society.
So you talked about a need for restraint sort of within the coalition. The coalition is being pulled in all different directions, right? I mean, we have the Ra'am party that has demands when it comes to the Temple Mount. And then you have the Yamina party, which has, let's say, opposite demands when it comes to the Temple Mount and other issues. So where do you identify sort of the weaknesses or the people who are not willing to show as much restraint?
Well, I think that it's absolutely clear that most of the problems come from the party of the Prime Minister himself. You know, this is the main problematic issue. I think that the fact that the more shaky member of Knesset are presumably Abir Kara or Nir Orbach or Ayelet Shaked. So this is the main problem of Naftali Bennett. I think that the problems are not with the Meretz party or with the Labour party or with the Ram party. This is not the issue entirely. We want this government. We want to strengthen this government. And yes, there are some, you know, bitter discussions about certain issues, but no doubt, know what is the true democratic procedure. We know how to struggle with each other and at the same time to remain united, because this is what Israel is needed.
Well, I share the view with you that this government is something of a miracle to be able to bring right and left together. I think listeners definitely in the United States who you can't even imagine a moderate Republican sitting today with a moderate Democrat. It's like unheard of. The fact that we're able to have Yair Golan in the same coalition with someone like Ayelet Shaked is, yes, a miracle. And to have in that the Arab participation is also historic. But there are those who would say that you and your party, who are so anti-settlements, let's say, who are pushing in a more left-wing direction, are partially responsible for the fact that Yamina members have had to pull out and they felt that they are no longer achieving what they wanted to achieve in this government.
Yes, but Yaakov, that was the deal. You know, the deal is about how to save Israel from the hands of a corrupted Netanyahu, supported by the most would say messianic members of the Knesset, who are completely dangerous to the destiny of Israel. And I think that what we brought to the Israeli public is a kind of a normality. Yes, we can struggle over this issue and other issue. Yes, there are, you know, we so opposed the we we so heavily support the idea of separating ourselves from the Palestinians. And yes, Yamina is more in the arena of annexation. Yes, there are bitter, you know, discussions between us. But with all that, I think that we need to make priorities. And the first priority for Israel is to save Israel from the hands of corruption and messianic approach to history and to the destiny of Israel. I think this is the issue, the main issue. And I think that we handle politically ourselves in the most responsible way. And being responsible is to demonstrate, you know, a certain level of maturity, a certain level of responsibility, in sense of, yes, we know how to make priorities. And first priority is to save Israel. Second priority is to make the right decisions concerning the most crucial issues or the most crucial challenges facing Israel in the near future.
So just over the weekend, the planning board approved almost 4,000 new homes in Judea and Samaria and the West Bank. And that is anathema to everything that Meretz believes in. So that, I guess, to me is an example of what you're saying, that Meretz is able to sort of balance these different things. But how do you feel about that policy and how do you feel like it's being balanced out with meeting, I guess, what Meretz needs for its own electoral base and thinks is good for Israel?
I feel very bad with it because I think that, you know, the main issue, basically we escape from the most crucial issue for the destiny of Israel. What to do with the Palestinians? Should we annex 2.8 million Palestinians and maybe 4.9 million Palestinians if you include the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip? What should we do with them? To separate ourselves from them or to annex them? I think this is the most crucial issue for the destiny of Israel. You know, with all my experience with the, you know, with security activity in Judea and Samaria, a region where I served for, you know, more than 40 years, and I know the region and the people in the region in the most intimate way. And I came to the same conclusion as Ben-Gurion, as Prime Minister Rabin, as Prime Minister Sharon. We should disintegrate ourselves from the Palestinians. There is no future for Israel while combining together two people with, you know, more or less the same size of about, you know, 6.5 million people, Jews and Arabs, and try to mix them together and make one nation. This is just impossible. You cannot handle such a state. You know, I have so much experience fighting the Palestinians, and I learned this issue of insurgency and counterinsurgency for years. I'm a practitioner, you know, concerning counterinsurgency warfare. And with all my experience, I came to one very clear conclusion. We should disintegrate ourselves from the Palestinians. We should separate ourselves from the Palestinians. There is no other solution to the Palestinian problem.
But on that note, and you know, just so our listeners know, because I didn't go into so much detail when introducing you, but, you know, when you talk about the years that you have experience, not only were you a commander of a battalion of the Paratroopers Brigade and you went on to command the Nahal Brigade, but you were the commander of the division, I think the 91st Division along the border with Lebanon, and the commander of the Judean Samaria Division, and then also Northern Command and Deputy Chief of Staff. So you do have all those years of experience and you've seen a lot. But if you take that experience that you have and the current wave of terror and what you were just talking about now with that this has to be the solution, what is behind this wave that Israel is currently experiencing? How do you understand it?
You know, the current injection is almost irrelevant. You know, in most cases, it's something about Jerusalem. In most cases, you know, the level of flames controlled by, you know, Hamas, Jihadic Islam, other extremist faction in the region. Well, this is the issue more or less, you know, in each case. It was the same, pretty much the same in 2015 with the, you know, the wave of terror by stabbing and, you know, so on in the 2015, 2016. So it's pretty much the same issue. So therefore, we need to take the right decisions, and we need to take our destiny and not, you know, let the Palestinians control our destiny. What we are doing right now is keeping, you know, the same level of friction between the two people, or even intensify the friction between the two people, with no future, with no solution, with no promise for the Jewish people in Israel. All right, what next? How would we secure the destiny and the future of our children and grandchildren? This is the issue. All right, what is the vision for Israel 50 years from now, 60 years from now? This is the issue. And yes, even if it's hard to discuss the issue of peace right now, I don't see any prospect for peace with annexation. And what we are doing right now in Judea and Samaria is a certain level of slow annexation.
But if I could ask you, I mean, if I could push back on that for a moment, you know, I hear what you're saying, and it's an impassioned plea. And part of me agrees with some of what you're saying, but then how can you also support this government? Because this government, if anything, when it comes to the Palestinian, can only be described as the status quo government, right? This is a government that's not going to do anything. There's not going to be any movement on the Palestinians.
You are right. You are totally right. But I think that first and foremost, we need to get rid out of corrupted people and messianic elements in the Knesset, in the Israeli publicity. This is the main problem for Israel. We should not give the responsibility for the destiny of Israel for a person who is totally corrupted, you know, according to my opinion, or to let you know, figures like Itamar Ben-Gvir to become ministers in the Israeli government. It's so dangerous to our destiny that, you know, I have no words to describe it. There is no future, you know, for any nation on earth in corruption and, you know, extreme nationalism, a messianic approach to history and future. You know, this is totally dangerous for Israel. So therefore, we need to make priorities. And first priority is to save Israel. Second priority is to make the right decisions. And yes, the right decisions are, you know, hiding in the future, and we cannot escape to make a true decisive decision concerning the Palestinian problem, which is, according to my opinion, the most crucial problem for the destiny of Israel, even more important than the Iranian issue.
So if you look at the makeup of the current Knesset and at the polls, I mean, it looks the majority of voters support parties that think that what you're describing, sort of a two-state solution, is a pipe dream, right? The most of the Knesset, something like 70-something seats, opposes a two-state solution or supports a version of the two-state solution that would never have, I mean, the Palestinians wouldn't want anything to do it. And the left doesn't seem to be gaining in the polls at all over, I mean, it's shrunk over decades now. It's maybe stabilized a little bit. And this government, I mean, it's hard to imagine a government like this ever happening again. So what is the future for Meretz and more broadly even the Israeli left?
Well, I think that the Israel left is in a problem. And I enter the political arena exactly because of that. Because I think that I'm a kind of a person who can contribute, modestly, to consolidate the Israeli left, the Zionist left, and to make the Zionist left a prominent element in the Israeli politics again, like it was before. I think that this notion of being Zionist on the one hand, and on the other hand, being part of a leftist movement that put, the human being in the center of its activity, I think this is absolutely crucial for Israel, for the political system of Israel, for the Israeli publicity, and for the Israeli public. And therefore, I think that, there is much to do. And, it's not just about the Palestinian issue. It's also about what kind of economy we're going to have, what kind of relationship are going to be between the state and religion. And it's about equality. What about equality? Each issue is problematic. Each issue is about struggle with others. And there is no agreement about each one of them. But I came to fight, and I came to struggle for my opinions, for my ability to look to the future and build with others better society, a society that will ensure the willingness of young Israelis to live in Israel. I think this is the most. This is the true danger for the destiny of Israel, the willingness of the young to live in Israel. This is the issue. And you cannot promise something good for young Israelis, talented and with good education, by promising them, a more religious country, fundamentalist religion country, by promising them corruption, by promising them extreme nationalism, which is brutal and violent. So therefore, we need to fight them. And I came, I fought all my life, and I feel that the current battle is even more important than the battles I experienced in the last 38 years.
And maybe harder as well.
It's even harder. It's even harder because, struggling with your own people is much more difficult comparing, fighting against enemies. I remember all the time that even the people I dislike, entirely, they are part of my people. And therefore, by the end of the day, we need to live together.
I want to ask you about the op-ed that was published last week in the Jerusalem Post that you wrote about the Iran deal. And you basically, your premise was that the delisting of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, by the United States should not prevent a nuclear deal. And you write here that the best option, basically, is still a renewal of the 2015 JCPOA. So if you could explain to our listeners why you think that is the case, because that does kind of run up against the standard Israeli policy that we hear often from Foreign Minister Lapid or Prime Minister Bennett. Why do you see things differently?
Well, as a deputy chief of the general staff, I was the one who got the responsibility for leading all the staff work concerning the Iranian case. I think that I know the Iranian issue, you know, in and out. And I can assure you that no other measure halt the Iranian nuclear initiative like the JCPOA. You know, it's really capture our mind, all kind of, you know, clandestine operations, you know, conducting by the Mossad and other intelligence organizations around the globe. Yes, it's fascinating, it's James Bond-like, you know, operations, but I can assure you that no other measure halted the Iranian initiative like the JCPOA. So therefore, the JCPOA was not perfect. Yes, I admit it, you know, first and foremost, but the JCPOA was good for the security of Israel. And there is no other measure which is so effective in halting the Iranian initiative. Therefore, I think that renewal of the JCPOA is good for Israel. It's not, you know, because I, you know, have some hesitations concerning future Israeli operations on Iranian soil. This is not the issue. The issue is, what is the most effective measure concerning slowing down the Iranian initiative, halting the Iranian initiative, and you need the agreement? Well, you know, it could be fantastic to see the 7th Fleet and the 6th Fleet and the 5th Fleet, you know, fighting against the American fleets, you know, fighting against Iran tomorrow morning. That could be fantastic.
Right.
But there is no intention by the United States of America to do so. And therefore, we need to be realistic. And being realistic is supporting such an agreement. It's good for Israel. It's good for the region. It's not perfect. I'm the first to admit it's not perfect. But it's the most effective measure concerning the Iranian initiative.
So if I can sort of read between the lines of what you're saying, you don't think that Israel could stop an Iranian bomb on its own. Is that right?
Well, we have a lot of capabilities. Yes, a lot of capabilities. We can do something which is really effective concerning the Iranian initiative, but we cannot stop it. And we need to think about the day after. All right, what is next? What would be the situation in the region the day after? And if you take all scenarios into account, I believe that any reasonable person will adopt the same notion. We need an agreement. The agreement is good for Israel. I'm talking about agreement which is pretty much the same, you know, or according to the lines of the JCPOA. And maybe in the future, we will improve the JCPOA, because the JCPOA has a limited time period. And no doubt that after 10 to 15 years, we need to do something else. And maybe during this time, it truly depends on the Iranian behavior, we will come to other conclusion with the Americans, with others, with the Europeans, and maybe with others, concerning what to do with the Iranian problem. The Iranian problem, yes, is not just the problem of Israel. It's also a problem for all the free world.
Right. Okay, well, member of Knesset, former General Yair Golan, thank you so much for joining us and being on the Jerusalem Post podcast. We wish you lots of luck in this Knesset session, and hope, at least I do, like you, that this that it manages to keep itself together over the next couple months, because we all know it's not going to be easy. So best of luck, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I can promise you one thing, I'll do my best. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find the podcast on Spotify, Apple, all the major podcasting platforms. If you enjoyed it, please forward it to your friends and family, and we'll be back next week.